Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
He's got so many things, like little figurines and stuff. They're actually hanging from the ceiling, and they're stuck on upside down, and it's everywhere. It's actually intimidating.
He's lost all the room. He had to hang stuff from the ceiling.
And he's got a girlfriend.
Yeah, who deals with it somehow?
Figure
right?
that out. How does that work?
In an apartment.
You're gonna get rid of that stuff, aren't you?
Right. Oh my! So, how long you guys been doing this, and why
how
did
long
you
have
start
been doing,
doing it?
Work.
He was out of work.
Yeah.
And I didn't. I was not a podcast guy. I didn't listen to podcasts.
It wasn't even that. I had just done one. Some guys came over to my house and just recorded it on my porch. We sat around drinking tequila, talking movies. And I knew this, but I hadn't experienced it. How easy it is to do a podcast and fun. And I said to Joe, because he does Trailers from Hell that we both work on, I was like, you need to do a podcast. And someone had convinced Joe that it was this huge, complicated process and you needed a...
Well, maybe it was Ileana, because she kept saying, well, you know, it's really hard. I have to do a lot of work because I gotta read about the people who are coming and I got to ask them questions. And so we said, we didn't want to do any of that. We wanted people to come and talk about stuff that was not
the
their career.
Right.
That was not the same interview they do all the time. Yeah. That was like, this is why I'm in the movies. This is why I'm in the movies. This is because of what I saw. And we found, I think, from the reaction to the show, that actually does hit a nerve with people because they find it, they can really relate to that a lot more easy than, I did some summer stock and, it's so it was a good choice.
But it was
a great way.
Coming up on 50.
And 50 shows?
We're almost on 50.
But how did you hook up with Joe for this?
Well, I've been doing stuff on Trailers from Hell, his website, for
a long time.
Commentaries on trailers.
Okay, gotcha.
But it really was, and it's not my fault. I said you should do a podcast, and then a friend of mine came by and sort of explained to Joe that any idiot can do a podcast, and then Joe emailed me and goes, we're going to do it, and you're going to be the idiot who hosts it. And he wasn't even, as far as I could tell, he was like, I think I'll come to the first one just to make sure you don't fuck it up. And for the first 10 or 11, we weren't even supposed to mention him. Like, I might come, came to all of them except one, and now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Once you figured out how that
it's a kibitzing. I just kibitz. Yeah. He doesn't even let me know what the subject.
Oh, is that
he lets
right?
me know who the person is,
right?
But he never says what we're going to talk about.
I keep waiting for someone to come in and go like, "Yeah, new wave Chechenian films from the 50s," and have Joe completely flummoxed.
Because it would be nice to be able to do a little bit of research, like just remind myself the names of these people, you know?
Yeah, but you don't want to do any research.
Instead, I'll email you next time. I thought you enjoyed it. I didn't know.
It's fun. It's fun to have a surprise. But you know, if it is Chechenian films, that's not a good surprise for me. Seen enough of them.
I keep waiting for that one where we both just sort of sit there and go, explain to us why you like these movies we've never heard of.
We had people doing sexploitation. We had people doing porno. I mean,
really?
Not really.
So have you told Joe what our subject is yet?
No, my point. That's
we're going to wait till we start recording to figure it out.
Oh, no, we've been recording.
No, that's the show. It's almost over.
Yeah, the show's almost done.
I showed up late.
Okay, so.
And you guys edit this later?
He edits it.
Oh, good. Good.
And he puts in music, and if you say bad things, he takes it out.
You know, I feel like we can talk about anything.
You can talk about anything you want.
And go off on weird side tangents that you...
Better. We're going to run music here to introduce... Don't worry. But is there anything... I want to ask you before, and I didn't, but is there anything... I've got sort of my introduction, but is there anything you want me particularly to, like, hype? Or, I mean, it's...
Oh, hype? Not really. I mean, okay. I don't know. When is this going to air?
Well, usually when we started, it would be like a month after we did it. But now it's usually just a couple of weeks.
This could be a couple of weeks.
I got my movie Crown Vic got into the Tribeca Film Festival, but that's at the end of this month, so it probably won't matter.
So we're not hyping it for
no, I guess not.
But it will have been. Right. It will have been at the Tribeca Film Festival.
It will have been. Right. Yeah, that's the other thing too.
It was well received at the Tribeca Film Festival.
Yeah, that's a great thing. I'm doing these sort of early and then sitting there. Yeah. You know, you get to make these. I get to listen to them when I'm editing them, and I'm like, the Mueller Report's going to bring them down. I absolutely. Oh, shit.
He has a good voice
it
for
might,
it.
Yeah.
You have a good voice for it.
Oh, that, we're leaving that part.
Yeah,
in.
You better.
Because the joy of not having, you know, I literally didn't. I'm happy to do it, and I love doing it, but I did not go. You know, I was like, Joey, you should do this. And he threw me in here. I am not at all.
Right.
And people complain.
We get complaints about his voice.
I can't
not about
hear
what
him.
He says, but he mumbles. Or he's too mumbled, far from the mic, or he's too close to the mic.
Well, he's learning, though. After 50.
I think by 50, I'll sort of sort it out.
And by the way, am I okay here? Is this close enough for me? Okay, good.
We're just
mess around.
Some guests we have to sort of crack the whip on it. I was like, I'm guessing this guy knows how to talk,
talk it to a microphone. Feel free to tell if I, you know, because I don't know. I get carried away sometimes too. So.
This is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
Very excited here. We've got a guest whose work I was trying to remember. You're just one of those guys who, like, you know, about the fifth time I saw you in something, I was like, I've been seeing this guy forever. But I mean, nice, you know, stuff like Boogie Nights and you were just sort of, I feel like you were always around. Like, I feel like if I
hovering on the fringes,
I feel like I could turn on some old Bogey film and there you'd be in the background, young you. But I just want to throw you, I mean, everyone knows our guest, Thomas Jane. We're very, very, very happy to have you here. Sort of apropos of the kind of movies I like, and I think the kind of films we're going to talk about, not only have you done, you know, The Punisher and The Mist, star of the HBO series Hung, the recent The Predator, co-written by Fred Dekker. Guest on the show.
Fred's great.
And Fred, one of the stars of The Expanse on the Sci-Fi Network. But Stander, I love Stander.
Right on.
Stander was wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, true very story. We rewrote the script once we got to South Africa because the real story was so much cooler than what they had sort of filled in. But we interviewed guards and they said, no, this is how they really broke out, which we ended up filming. You know, it was a really neat experience.
Nice. It's a terrific film. I feel like it didn't get the kind of...
Because everybody talks in a South African accent. That's why.
Yeah.
Because
it's disconcerting when you think you're seeing a foreign film but it's got Americans.
And I turned it down at first. I was like, but nobody wants to see a movie with everybody has a South African accent, and I was right.
It's nonetheless a terrific film, and it does kind of tie into some of the stuff. You're right, and I forgot. Yeah, especially when we talk Prison Break, because I reached out to Thomas to come on the show, and you're the greatest idea. No one's done this yet. I had no idea you were a fan of this stuff, but he basically said, "I want to do great French crime films,"
which Joe is learning about for the first time right now.
That's all right. I've seen some.
Joe's seen some.
A few have crossed my path.
It was an excuse to go back and watch or rewatch a couple. Great stuff. I don't need to ask, why do you like this stuff?
Right, I mean, right. I know, because it's great.
Yeah, you
know?
There you go.
I've always been a fan of noir, you know. That really turned me on, and it continues to turn me on. So just in your sort of path of saying what else is out there, you know, you start looking at, eventually you start, you know, going, hey, they made movies in other countries, you know, when you're American, you know, it's very interesting how secular we are, how closed off we are. But when you open up that box, it's just just mind-bogglingly cool how and how underappreciated I think these films are, you know. And I'm sure
underseen, I think.
Underseen, underknown, you know. There's guys out there like we'll talk about Melville, Jean-Pierre Melville. I mean, Jesus, this guy should be this.
Moby Dick was good.
Posters. who he named himself after, Melville.
Right. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But, you know, why do I like crime? I was thinking about that.
Oh, wow. That's an even better question. Yeah, answer that, because I've been struggling with that question for many years.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, it's a common thing. Like, if artists, if you ask them, like, when, what would you have done if had you not been able to be a director, actor, writer?
Very few of them say I'd be a criminal. Producers, on the other hand. Yeah.
You know, John Waters, I don't know if he still does it, for years and years and years, taught writing in prisons in Baltimore. And his reason, and he always seemed very sincere when he said this, is because if I had not discovered this, I would be one of these guys.
That's what I was about to say.
Oh, is that okay? I remember reading that and just going, God, that makes so much sense.
We are outsiders, you know, we are. And so that's what turns me on. It's the outsider aspect of these guys. It's the fact that they nonetheless exist outside of society. They have a very tight-knit society that they are all beholden to. And if you know, it's the quote-unquote unspoken code that's so popular for us to think about, you know, that the but there's a bond that these guys create, which in many ways is much stronger than the laws that we are all beholden to and are taught. Yeah, and I just think it's funny the way that, you know, we're brought up in this world. We're brought up to follow rules. We're literally basically being educated to be workers, you know, with an authority figure at the top of the class, and the fact that if you break the rules, you will be punished, and the meaningless work that's given to you, and the why are we doing this question that's never answered in any of the most vaguest terms, to get into a good school. And no real value on value, you know, no real emphasis. And that's the stuff you learn on the playground. And on the playground, you either discover that you are a rule follower on the inside and want to be liked and you have lots of friends, and or you discover that you're kind of an outsider and a bit of a weirdo. And that was me as a kid. So I've always just naturally loved movies about outsiders who nonetheless were created their own society, you know. And the society that they created has its own rules and its own extremely tight bonds. So for me, it's loyalty, honor, respect.
Well, that would explain why you like crime films, because, you know, the crime family, the Godfather people, you know, they have their own rules and their own world and their own loyalties.
And they are extremely bound to these rules, you know, in such a way that if you break them, you know, and we kill you, then that's just part of the... That's part of the game, you know. But that, and so I, when rewatching the movies that I chose for, you know, you asked me to make a sort of a list, and in rewatching them, I was like, wow, you know, these, like, in their own way, are all exploring this aspect of the, you know, the criminal world. It's not so much about breaking the law as it is about maintaining or the bonds that, you know. That
there's the great, what's the song from? The great Dylan line, you know, to live outside the law, you must be honest.
Right.
Yeah, right through my head a lot as I was. That's great. Revisiting some of these. Well, on the flip side, I mean, well, it'll be one of the films I'm sure we're talking about. I was showing something to my wife the other night, and she loved it. It was one of these films. When we get to the end, in which character has sacrificed his life because he must, And she just goes, ugh, men and their fucking codes.
Yeah.
She's like, yeah, right? Women aren't this stupid. I was like, oh, honey, honey, you'll never understand. She's probably right.
Oh, man. Yeah, and they are very male-centric. The movies that we're going to talk about are very male-centric. You know, there's one, I wanted to throw one in there that dealt with romantic relationship, it's you know, and one was one of the commenters on one of the Melville films said it's homosocial. You know, it's not homoerotic, you know, whichever in America we just love to like throw around, you know, anytime fucking two guys are friends, it's homoerotic.
Right.
It's homosocial, you know, it's the bonds between men. It's this male society, you know, and that's what these movies focus on. And today, I suppose, people would call them misogynistic. I don't think they're misogynistic at all, you know. Men exist, you know, and women exist, you know, in the world of women, and men exist in the world of men, and they're very different and separate, and they have their own rules and their own desires, and their own, we have our own ways of doing things. And the crime film especially explores that homosocial reality.
But the nice thing, especially to and I don't know if anybody would lob those charges at these films, but the French especially, I mean, even if there's a female character with only one scene, she's invariably strong as hell, really complicated and really interesting. So it's not...
In France.
Yeah, in France.
And she gets beaten up, so...
Yeah. Or occasionally does the beating.
Or killed.
Or killed. Yeah. Or does the killing.
Usually. Yeah. It's also interesting there's no real femme fatale in French crime movies, or at least not the ones that we're going to talk about today. It's interesting. And you know, and a lot of these most of the crime films we're going to talk about have taken place after the noir revolution. A few of them are pre-war, but so the French were really influenced by film noir. And I just think it's fascinating that as influenced as they were, they didn't really pick up on this femme fatale thing, you know, and it's curious. I'm not sure why that is, but found it to be really fascinating, you know, that the things that they picked up on, the isolation, the, you know, the man in trouble, the crime, the gangster stuff, they left out. The femme fatale is something that didn't, like, really
But that character seems to come out of some kind of sexual repression a little bit, you know, and Americans are much more repressed than the
Good
French.
Good point.
You know, the French all have these, well, they don't all, but the notion of, you know, open relationships and all that. They're like, you know, so there's not going to be a femme fatale in some French guy's life.
You're right. And you know, in movies made in the 1950s, guy goes into a club and there's a beautiful painting of a naked woman splashed across the back wall, or photographs of, you know, naked girls. And it's just part of the decor. Right. And, you know, it's whereas in America, that could never happen, you know, for a long time, not in the 50s. And that's fast. So there it is. There's your answer.
But yeah, do you want to just start with one and dive in?
Well, why don't we start with Le Samurai?
By the way, is the one my wife was. Men in their fucking codes.
Yeah, you know, we might as well start with something really.
Well, that's really
start with a bang
for so much American film, I think, over here. I think about like. I don't know, just looking at it again, because it's such a great film watching. I kept thinking of like Walter Hill sitting at a theater somewhere, probably with like five other people going, oh shit, I could steal this. I mean, in the best way possible. It's one of the things that drives me crazy when you go to screenings.
It's called influence.
You see a lot of foreign films, and even in LA, I'm surprised how empty the audiences, the theaters are sometimes, because I'm sitting there going, forget having a great aesthetic experience. They're handing you stuff that you could be robbing blind, and how do you not know this?
It was easier to do that in the 60s when the movies were dubbed, and they were. It was a much wider audience.
True.
But today, people just don't want to read those titles.
Yeah.
In fact, I think the Lumley Theaters or one of the chains has a motto: "We're not afraid of subtitles."
Right. Oh my God, this is terrifying! This is a world that I'm not I'm not aware of the, how things have changed. I mean, even as a kid, you know, growing when I was a young man in the 90s, and then and even in the 2000s, I'd go to the theater all the time, and people were going to the movies. But this is depressing and horrible. We talk about these movies, and then so frustrating.
Well,
oh
but these
God.
Movies actually can be seen now on Netflix and Amazon and places like that. I mean, they're more available than they were generally,
and probably much more widely seen.
I would think, although not with an audience, which I think makes a difference. I think it's a different experience
if you see
in the theater,
and
it is. If you want to do it at home, it's the same movie. Yeah. It's not the same experience.
And it's something that we're losing. That experience is getting lost.
And that's why I think this whole brouhaha about the Academy Awards and Netflix and Spielberg and this whole thing about, they want to keep the exhibition idea alive because that's the way we all learn to love movies. Now, what I think they don't take into consideration is that the generation that's coming up did not learn to love movies that way. They learned to love movies on their computer and on YouTube and places like that, that they could get them in DVDs and VHSs, which was a tremendous change. The VHS was changed everything.
Right.
And so the idea, the romantic idea of seeing movies in a theater with an appreciative audience is still the ideal for me. I mean, it's still, that's the way to see. You haven't seen it if you haven't seen it that way. But I think that that's becoming much less likely to be a place where people are going to encounter these movies.
Well, I read Spielberg's, plea to separate Netflix movies from in the Academy, and I agree with it 100%. I was very distraught to see that all of the rebuttal in every single article that I read all supported Netflix, which only tells me that, I think the media has been bought by a whole bunch of really
Netflix
powerful
is the media.
Corporations. Exactly. So what you're essentially reading is Netflix's rebuttal to Spielberg's statement.
Trying to look up because I can't remember who it is. It was like yesterday, the day before. Was it Helen Mirren who gave that great speech?
Yes, Helen Mirren said,
I love Netflix,
but fuck Netflix.
Yeah.
And she said that, of course, to a whole bunch of exhibitors.
Yes.
You might imagine.
Well, yeah.
I'd be happy to hear that.
So Le Samurai, where?
Okay, 1967. I made some notes because I'm dumb. And making the notes forced me to think, I mean, I put on these movies and I love them and I think about it a little bit. But this was great. I got to tell you how excited I was to do this podcast, because once we, because I don't like doing podcasts, I don't like interviews. This is something I would avoid like the plague. But the idea of talking about movies that I love sparked something in me that gave me permission to literally spend like 3 days just watching my French crime films, which was this fantastic excuse, because every one time someone would call, I'd be like, I'm doing a podcast on Thursday. I'm on assignment. So that was terrific. And then the other terrific thing was that I got to do a little bit of research and dig in to a little bit to why I love these movies and what was interesting about them. So I made a few notes that I might refer to.
This is the guest we designed the show for. I like to think everyone who comes in here is at least thinking what you just said, but thank you.
Do you want to start? Do you want to give a little summary of the film? Are we hoping that many people haven't
We're hoping to inspire folks to see.
I think we have to assume that a large portion of the audience is not familiar with this subject.
Right. Well, that's great. And if we can turn some folks on to a few of these movies, I promise you, you'll never forget them, and it will enrich your love for film and crime, hopefully.
Or at least one of them, yes.
Let's see. So, Alain Delon, okay. We'll talk a little bit about it. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the actors, some of these French dudes that probably, have been largely forgotten in America. America, but they were huge international stars at the time. Alain Delon was certainly one of them. By 67, he was quite a big star. He came in, you know, he was had a lot of odd jobs. He came from a divorced family. His parents, both French, fought a lot. Stormy childhood, odd jobs. And finally, as a young man, he discovered acting, I think in like 57. And pretty much right away, I think it was 1960, he did Visconti, cast him in Rocco and His Brothers, and he became an international star. The guy looks like James Dean. He's the epitome of French cool. Just a, you know.
And Purple Noon was other. Another,
and Purple Noon. Oh, my God. He did Purple Noon. He did The Leopard. He worked with Fellini on that little short movie with the Spirits one where they did these three. No, these three short films.
Yes, Spirits of the Dead. That was Louis Malle. He was in Louis Malle.
Oh, was that? He was in the Louis Malle. Oh, right, right. Of course. Of course.
John Stamp was in the Fellini.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. Louis Malle with the gambling, with these gambling.
But nonetheless, it was a big star movie.
Well, he was so gorgeous. Oh, my God. This guy, you know, I mean, and he had a double. Oh, it was based on that short story, right? Where he's the.
William Wilson, yeah.
Yes. Right, the Edgar Allan Poe one, right? It's great. Wow. You really don't have to do any research.
I know some stuff. But anyway, you're doing great on Alain there.
So, he retired just last year. The guy did six decades.
Still looks great.
And he was a star in all of those decades. Yeah. I mean, he was, I would say, the French Tom Cruise.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he was. He said that he's sick of the world. This is in 2018. He said, "I'm sick of the world and ready to die,
Jesus,
I want to take my dog with me."
That's ominous. By the way, there's a great, and I just tracked down. I keep trying to get a good version of this, and I'm always dissatisfied, but I might have found a French Blu-ray that just came out. He did a film with Belmondo called Borsellino.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I just ordered it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jean-Paul Belmondo and.
From Amazon France?
And Alain Delon. I just got it on Amazon.
That was an art house hit.
What? Because it's like it showed at the Egyptian once, can never find a good copy of it with subtitles.
Well, I just ordered it. I think it's like a Hungarian copy or something.
Yeah, probably has subtitles. A French one. I got a Japanese one that had no subtitles, which is really frustrating. But
I'll let you know.
But it's incredible. You have not seen it?
No.
It's Coppola took so much of the look from The Godfather this
great.
Film.
Wow.
I mean, it's just a visual feat.
And the hats.
And the hats.
The Delon film I try to turn everybody onto is one called The Last Adventure with Lino Ventura and Joanna Shimkus, which was Robert Enrico, the guy who did the Currents at Owl Creek Bridge. And it's an adventure picture, and it's just, it was a big hit actually at the time in France, and then Universal bought it and released it as a second feature, so people didn't really see it very much. But it's available from Movie Detective, and if I may plug Movie Detective, it's a place to get really good copies of foreign films that may not know even exist, but it's a great library, and they're very reasonable. And they're all region. So if you go on Movie Detective,
what's the name of the movie?
Movie Detective. That movie is called The Last Adventure.
Adventure.
Which I think is called The Adventurers in France.
Ah,
but anyway, it's really good. You'll love it.
I'll check that out. Yeah.
So anyway, we've established that Alain has done okay for himself,
and now he's
jaded and wants to die.
Not for Borsellino. Le Samurai is right. I mean, that's.
So if you haven't seen any Melville, if you haven't seen any Melville, would Le Samurai be a good place to start? That's my question. So here's the deal: Le Samurai is. The counterpoint to some of the other movies we're going to talk about, because it's about, you know, the lone assassin, the lone gun, you know, the guy who doesn't have any friends, who has everyone's a potential enemy, who has to live a life of solitude for his own survival. And Melville explores the consequences of that, you know, what that means. So as a result, it's.
And with a coat.
100%, a very strong code. He lives within the world and obeys its laws, and yet he is the ultimate outsider because he's the outsider of the outsiders.
Yes.
Which is why Melville, you know, in my opinion, you know, wanted to explore this. It's almost a counterpoint to the other movies that he did, which are all about outsiders binding together and the codes between them and how they must live or die based on those codes. This guy certainly is beholden to the code, but has no friends, can't have a real relationship with a woman, has people that will help him out, and then maybe even could love him if he would have let that happen. But he can't let it happen. He can never let his guard down. He's always being pursued and always watched. He's always watching his back, you know. And so this is the epitome of cool for Melville. It's shot in these steely, cold pastel colors. It's the only color film of our group too. Insanely gorgeous color. You know, the opening is like a still painting. It's this wide shot of his Paris apartment, and there's a couple of windows, and there's Delon laying on a bed, and he's smoking. So it's a wide shot. There's two windows on either side. It's raining. The cars are going by underneath the window. You can see the reflections of the cars on the ceiling. And there's a bird cage right in between. And the bird cage is twittering. The birds just tweet. And that's the only sound you hear, is that and the sounds of these occasional cars going by. And it just holds. And Delon lights a cigarette. And you just see this in the corner of the room, this waft of cigarette smoke coming up. And in the credits, and it's mesmerizing, and the color, it looks like a painting, you know. And then something weird happens, you know. There's a great quote from Bushido comes up. Is it a real quote?
I don't know.
I think there's another movie where he quotes it, but it's a totally made up quote. So I'm not sure if this one is real or not. But it basically says the solid. There's only one, you know, the samurai. There's only one, you know, thing. Lives a life of utter solitude. Maybe the tiger of the jungle, you know, might have lived more solitude, maybe. And then the image starts
in and out.
Vibrate. Yeah, it's almost like he's jiggling the zoom or something, you know, and the perspectives, it starts sort of getting kind of shifty and change, and I never could figure out. And then Delon gets up, and you know, and he dons this. We watch him don this costume. You know, he goes into the mirror. He puts on his trench coat, which for Melville in the films he's done is this classic gangster uniform. And it's almost like watching a kid play dress up in the mirror. He's so young. But he's very, very seriously putting on his trench coat and adjusting his hat.
Very seriously, like the brim of his hat.
You know, and there's the other movie that we'll talk about, you know, Second Wind, where the mirror, and looking at yourself in the mirror, and Le Doulos, you know, the great movie with Jean-Paul Mondo, which is called The Hat, which means the informant. Melville plays with this mirror image a lot, you know, guys sort of taking stock of themselves in the mirror, so he does that. He goes outside and he steals a car. You know, you're thinking, maybe is this guy playing dress up at being a he's a gangster. He's stealing a car. Not only that, he's a pro.
He's got those rings.
He pulls out this key ring of all the blanks from like every make and model in France, and he starts trying the keys. And he's so cool about it, you know. There's a cop like three cars away. He doesn't give a shit. He's just sitting in his car. He puts his key ring on the seat, and he stares straight ahead, and just one at a time, he just tries every key until he finds one that fits and drives away. And that's sort of the beginning of the film. He's off to kill someone, and we watch him go about his, and just in brief, I'll summarize the film. And I'm not sure if we're going to give everything away.
Oh no, you don't. I mean, just
enough to make him want to watch it.
I'll summarize the film like this: he essentially goes after his. He performs his hit. He meets a beautiful black jazz musician who witnesses the hit, and then And he immediately gets busted by the cops. The cops are on to him. He gets put in front of the lineup. You know, he's obviously the guy. They bring in the black jazz musician. They're like, you know, is this the guy? And she looks right at him and says, no, no, I've never seen him before. And they have to let him go, but they know that he's the guy. Meanwhile, he goes to collect his money. And they, the people that he's working for, have heard that he's been arrested, so they try to kill him. So now, and the reason why we're watching, you know, this moment in this guy's life is that he's wanted by the people who he's working for. They want him out because he's, if he gets busted by the cops, then that'll lead directly to them. And of course, the cops, you know that he's guilty. And we watch him negotiate how to get out of it. You know, how is he going to get out of this one? And you just, it's Alain Delon, and the guy's such a pro. You figure, you know, he's going to get out of it. He's smart. He's crafty. He's got a girl that may or may not be in love with him, and she's going to provide an alibi, you know, and he's got, but it's the solitude of the guy is what we are confronted with, you know, and there's this incredible sequence where he escapes the cops. The cops are like, we've got this son of a bitch. We're going to put 50 guys on him. We're going to see where. So he's got 50 cops on the street and in the subway, and they're all tailing him, and they've all got these counters where they can switch on and off this light at headquarters to track Delon as he tries to work his way through the subway system in Paris. And he, of course, he catches on, and he just can't get away from these sons of bitches. The net is slowly closing in, and he twists and he turns, and it's this wonderful, beautiful, long, silent sequence of him basically jumping on trains and jumping off trains. Being followed by this girl and that guy, and just he can't get rid of these tails, and he finally does, as we expect him to, and he runs down a side street and jumps into a car, and now he pulls out his ring of keys, and now he's in the same situation that we saw in the very beginning, but all his cool is gone. He's trying to maintain cool. He's still staring straight ahead as he's trying these keys, but his eyes are shifting, and you can almost see the beads of sweat starting to come down. He doesn't quite sweat. He's Alain Delon's too cool for that, but you could tell the veneer, the visage has been broken. And from then on, we kind of know where this is going. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful essay or study of life alone. You know, the price of living by the life alone, by the code.
I love how everything he does in that film, it's just whatever he's presented with. It's like, okay, this is what I have to do now. It's even when the guy goes, what are you here for? He goes, I'm here to kill you. but just sort of, you know, it's like, well, I've been shot. Now I have to deal with this, you know, now I have to run from the cops. Yeah. Now I have to, there's just, there's never that moment of like, oh my God, what the fuck is going on?
And it's all the while he's thinking, I've got to get home and feed my canary.
That's right. That's right. That's part of the code, by the way.
Is that how he knows that some guys bust into his apartment while he's gone, the cops, and they hide a little transmitter.
That's right.
And I think one of the cops, before they leave, feeds the canary.
Yeah, he knows.
And that's when Jeff Costello is his name in the movie. When Costello comes home, that's how he knows someone's better.
Yeah, someone's first bird. He can tell there are eight fewer seeds. That was my wife was very, she's very keyed into animals. Nancy is, and she, as soon as she showed the bird, she's like, they're going to kill the bird. I'm like, they're not going to kill the bird. they don't kill the bird, by the way.
So, you know, so is this a great film to start with? My personal opinion is no. It's for Melville or even French crime films in general.
Oh, no, I think I know where you're going. Yeah, because it's very, I remember the first time I saw it was at a LACMA screening in the 80s. and it didn't quite click with me the way it did later.
Well, it's a very austere film.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think if you start,
and it's very measured, and it's very, you know, it's an art film.
And the French existentialism is very prominent in the film. You know, it's really Melville's only film about a lone wolf. You know, and it's sort of his antithesis film. Mm-hmm. You know, to the one that he just did right before that, which is Second Wind, right? Yeah.
So if you were going to start with one, you would start with Second Wind?
I would start... Second Wind is fucking brilliant. And Lino Ventura, who we'll talk about. It's brilliant. I might start there, yeah. I also wanted to talk a little bit about The Hat, you know. I think that might be my favorite. You know, Lodulos, the informant, with Jean Pell.
The Finger Man, it was called.
The Finger Man. It's great. Yeah. Second Wind is a fantastic place to start. It's just a great classic, beautiful crime film. Should we talk about that?
What's fascinating is it's only 1 year earlier, and it's such a completely different movie. I mean, except for the fact that it's about a criminal, but it's densely packed with characters and
right. And it's sort of it's in the same way an exploration of one guy's journey. Yep. But now we're looking at Lino Ventura, who is a fantastic French actor, sort of reminds me of a middle-aged Robert De Niro in a way, you know.
Very much. Really
strong. One of my favorites, is Ventura. And the other guy, so he plays the master criminal who escapes from prison in the very first scene. We watch him and three other guys escaping from this prison that looks exactly like the prison from another movie we might talk about, which is The Hole, Latrua, Becker, right? And so that movie, the entire film is about escaping from this prison, and Melville does it in about 90 seconds. and it's the same prison, and they're using the same escape method. You know, they're escaping in the exact same way from the same prison. I thought that was really, really neat. He's a master criminal. He's on the loose. He's got to be hidden by his pals, and he's being hunted by a ruthless inspector of police named Blue. Blue, played by Paul Maurice. And so this is, in a lot of ways, in the vein of Heat, you know, where we're watching. But what we're watching really is a guy's self-worth being challenged and ultimately destroyed. You know, we're watching this inspector who will go to any means. You know, he, in a lot of ways, the inspector does not have a code. You know, even though he is part of the police and he's got to, you know, follow all these procedures, when they nail him by throwing all that shit away and really pisses off Ventura. You know, they just broke every rule in doing this, and in breaking those rules destroys Lino Ventura's reputation on the street, which of course was intentional, but destroys Ventura in the process. You know, this guy's a master thief. He's been at it for a long time. He's older. He probably wants to retire. He's done. And, you know, he escapes from prison. And, you know, this is like what you do. You escape from prison, you use your buddies, you lay low for a few months. And, you know, his sister, who's also been a criminal her whole life, is her crime boss in her own right. And they've got a club and they've got friends and a tight-knit group of people. people, and they will hide him. They will get him his papers. They will get him on a boat, and they will get him the hell out of there, and they will set him up, and that's what they intend to do. But of course, all this gets thrown under the bus with this inspector who just won't quit and is not willing to play by the rules. You know, he's gonna break all the rules in order to bring him down.
No, I feel, but doesn't at the end the inspector kind of, there's a gesture on his part. He's aware of what he's done the wrong thing.
Yeah, which is great.
Which is kind of nice. I always love in those movies. It's just always a thing where that moment where the cop sort of recognizes that, you know, perhaps his prey is more noble than he is.
Perhaps Richard Kimball wasn't guilty after all.
Yeah, exactly. Except this guy's guilty as shit. I mean.
And of course, he pulls off a job in the middle of it all. You know,
incredible. One of the things that I love the French do so much, but Jules Dassin, I feel like, was a big proponent of this. I don't know what the sequence of events was, but if you look at Rafifi, and he was American who went to France because. Of the communist hearings, the blacklist. Rafifi has that amazing heist where you just go through every step of it. And that seems to be a thing that happens a lot in French crime films. I mean, we've lifted a lot of that over here, but all of these films, there's always that, there's at least one moment where everything just stops cold and you go through an entire process. Because the heist in that movie, I mean, you see every detail of it down to, I remember this is one of the ones I just watched because we were doing this, where they're sitting around waiting for the, they're up in the hills.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a Western robbery, like they're waiting for the stagecoach to come through the pass. They're basically up in the mountains.
Remember the guy smoking the cigarette and just flicking it on the bugs?
Yeah.
That's a great moment. Yeah. You just get that sense of just waiting on the job.
He's staring at the ants on the rocks and they're just looking and, you know, and the guys are bored and one guy's, you know, practicing pulling his gun out of his jacket and throwing it out the window. And the way that robbery is shot was impressive for me because it was so A, economical, and B, almost impressionistic in the action. You know, they only give you enough information so that you could see what's happening. The shots are. It feels like what it would feel like to be in the action when your heartbeat is going 160 beats a minute and you're only catching glimpses of what's happening in front of you because you're so wound up and in the moment. And that's the way it's filmed, not with a shaky camera or anything like that, just impressions of what is happening that struck me as very different from the Hollywood method, which is it's almost pornography. It's violence as pornography. You're going to see every, last moment of the cars and then all, you know, and there's going to be, shots of cars and wheels and hands and then the car flips over and then it rolls and then it explodes. You know, you see all of the action. Whereas here it's only exactly what you need to see to get to the next. So it moves and the pace is great and it's violent, but it's also incredibly economical and probably much faster to shoot. Probably got it done a lot quicker. But none of, you know, it's still it, none of the stuff that you expect today.
Yeah. And it seems to be in real time too, which is
the real time
that aspect, the heist. That's what I was saying. Was that, like, stylistically, do you have a sense of that evolving over here, over there, of
what, of real time,
just the, sort of the crime done in real time thing that feels
I guess when you go to the killing and you see the real crime done in real time over and over, right, from different angles, that's a sort of that was a different take sort of thing. But a lot of those movies really depend on the precision of the detail,
right?
And especially when these are supposed to be well thought out robberies, you know, until you get to the one mistake they make. You have to really see it and see the little nuances of what everybody's supposed to do at this time and in that time. That's why The Killing is a great example for that, because everything is carefully choreographed to happen at a certain time. And it's the only movie that shows you what's happening outside the last thing you saw. So, you know, if there's people who are supposed to do something to cause a disturbance, you see the beginning of what they're doing to cause that disturbance while you've already had the opportunity to see what's going on in the other part of the racetrack where the guys are, you know, getting the bags ready or you know, whatever.
And that was part of the novel. That was the way Lionel White laid out the novel, which was cool. And that's what Kubrick wanted to maintain. And they fought him on that, obviously, because nobody had, you know, done that. It was an interesting way. But I think Rafifi is probably the grandfather of the real-time, you know, execution of the robbery. I mean, it's got to be. I mean, I think that, you know,
yeah,
what is it?
Feels right.
Right?
Yeah.
But what is Rafifi? When was Rafifi? It was 59 or something? 57?
I thought it was earlier.
55?
But it's an interesting thing. And it seems to run through a lot of these movies.
55. You're right.
Yeah, the trick with foreign movies is that sometimes we didn't see
that's
it for
right,
2 years.
That's right, we didn't see it for a couple of years.
Yeah. We're not.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
What else do we want to say about... I want to talk about Lino Ventura a little bit, just because turn people on to Lino. This guy was actually a wrestler, and he was the European champion of Europe. That would make him the European champion. In 1953, he was a guy who never did publicity. He never liked the business of being a movie star. He just wanted to, never gave interviews, really, just wanted to do his work and be with his family. He dropped out of high school, had a lot of odd jobs. He was born Italian, but moved to France as a very young age. So when the war happened, he, was conscripted into the Italian army. Yeah. And then he immediately deserted and, went back to France, because he felt like that was his home. So of course the French loved him for that. you know, and outside of being the French movie star, you know, you feel like he never had any affairs. He was married to the same woman for 23 years and they had 4 kids together. And so he was so in love with his wife that you had to coax him into doing love scenes. He hated kissing another woman on screen. You really had to sort of, you know, be very gentle and careful about how you got him into doing that. So that you rarely see Lino, you know, in a love scene with a woman, and he wouldn't do it. He loved his wife, you know, which goes against the, you know, the typical French sort of thing that we think.
And Italian.
You know, and right.
Yeah.
Ventura is one of those underspoken, you know, for a guy, he's kind of like, imagine if The Rock was a great actor, you know? it would just be so incongruous, we wouldn't be able to put it together in our minds, and that's Lino Ventura, He's sort of like, imagine the Rock became like Robert De Niro, you know. There you have Lino Ventura, right. Sort of this anomaly, just fantastic. You know, I just love the way, I love his look, I love the way he talks, I love his understated ability, natural, just one of those guys that just got it right away. You know, from his very first film, Hands Off the Loot. You know, he became the European champion of wrestling, and then immediately got injured and was out of the game. Didn't know what the hell to do with himself. So he eventually, you know, he heard that they were looking for gangsters for this movie, Hands Off the Loot, which turned out to be Jean Gabin. Am I saying that right? His comeback movie. You know, he was the biggest star in France before the war. The guy was Spencer Tracy and Humphrey Bogart all rolled up into one. He was just a wonderful guy. And then the war happened, and with a lot of careers, he sort of got reshuffled and forgotten and lost, and he got older, and he got a little fatter and a little grayer, and he was out of work, and he was out of work for quite a few years. And then finally, this film, Hands Off the Loot, was a wonderful crime film, and that's what made his comeback in. And it happened to be Lino Ventura's very first film, where he plays sort of the bad mobster.
I got a theatrical release here a few years ago. Yeah. I remember seeing it at the New Art.
Well, it was released here originally. It was Grisby, as it was.
Grisby.
Touché pas le Grisby.
Exactly.
Touché pas le Grisby.
Yeah, yeah. Another Becker, Jacques Becker movie. So that's my bit on Lino Ventura. You know, you want to talk about Hands Off the Loot?
I have seen it.
No?
Okay.
Is that,
okay. No, all
right.
No, the hat is the one that I thought you were.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about the hat.
Which one? Oh, the hat.
Le Duluth. Yeah.
Which I've not seen. So I'm the guy you're trying to rope into this one.
Bob the Gambler was Melville's first crime
Bob
film.
Bob Le Flambeur.
Bob Le Flambeur. That's his first crime film. And the hat would have been his second. So, you know, Melville had done some art movies. He did a Jean Cocteau film, L'Enfant Terrible. Beautiful, you know, but of course nothing made any money. So he said, I better do something a little more commercial. And that's when he got into Bob the Gambler, which is brilliant and... So it stars Serge Reggiani, mm-hmm. And Jean-Paul Belmondo, and Michel Piccoli has a little part, and he's a wonderful French actor. So I thought that this was sort of Melville riffing on the mythical noir gangster movies of the 30s and 40s. Everybody's got trench coats and the hats, and it's got what I think is the best opening of any Melville film. It starts out underneath the underpass and in the dark, and it's black and white, and then we're tracking shot, and we're just watching this figure in a trench coat and a hat walking along underneath the underpass, and we see the the grating on the underpasses, and he just, it's just this long tracking shot where we're just watching this guy walk, you know, from darkness into light and then darkness again. And it's a jazz score underneath in the credits, and it's just so evocative. It's so gorgeous. You're just in right away, you know. And then he stops, and the camera kind of, this is Serge Reggiani, stops, and the camera just kind of pushes in on him a little bit, and then we're off to the races, you know. He shows up at this lonely house in the middle of nowhere, and he walks up the stairs, and this old man is taking apart some jewels. He's separating the diamonds from the gold, and this is his buddy, is sort of a fence or a go-between kind of character. And they have this conversation where we learn that he's just got out of prison, We start putting together this story slowly in bits and pieces. You know, Melville only gives you little pieces. You know, he ends up shooting this guy who you think is his friend. They just had this sort of, do you want any money? Do you need anything? We can put you up for the night. You know, this guy's really going out of his way to to help Serge Reggiani. And, you know, Serge goes, hey, you got a gun I can borrow? And he's like, yeah, it's in the top drawer. And he walks over and he opens the drawer with his pinky. And you're like, uh-oh. and he pulls out the gun and he shoots the guy. Yeah. And you're like, why did that happen? And we slowly put together this story throughout the movie. Who's going to be the informant? You know, they're always like, we're going to pull his job, but what about this other guy? I don't quite trust that guy. You know, no. That guy's been a friend of mine for a long time. This other guy, you know, I'm not so sure. What about your friend? You know, why do you vouch for him? You know, and then Jean-Paul Belmondo shows up. And he's Alain Delon, just the epitome of French cool. And you're just like, this guy's got it all together, and he's probably gonna end up leading these guys. And no, he's the informant. You're like, wait a second, this is the guy who's friends with the cops, who's running around. It's a very tight noir tale. What I love about it is it has no moral viewpoint. You know, Melville never takes a moral stance on these characters. You know, it's really a story about the ambiguity of loyalty and betrayal. What that means and to who. And I think that that's that kind of ambiguity is baked into the way that Melville tells the story. You know, he holds back critical information that we only get pieces of a story, which we slowly kind of put together throughout the film. So where at the same time, you know, and the films that he was commenting on, the films that he was obviously in love with, had very clear a moral stance, you know. I mean, it's right. The old Hollywood morality, yeah. You know. Yeah. I mean, if you,
that guy
has
to die.
Yeah, and they have rules, you know. If you had to die. If you cheat somebody out of, you have to die. If you kill somebody, well, you have to die. If you do wrong, you know, you must be punished, and that's the way it works. And that's why the cops close in on you at the end. But none of that commentary exists, you know, with these guys, and it puts the emphasis on the relationships between our outlaws, you know. We'll see what else. He loved to use rear screen projection, and this is like, what was this, 1962, you know. Nobody was doing that stuff, or people were, which is funny because they call Melville the godfather of neorealism. You know, all the guys, Truffaut and everybody else, was like, you know, Melville, he's our, you know, spiritual father, because he brought of the realism. Melville loved his rear screen projection when nobody was doing it, and he loved his optical dissolves and his misty flashbacks, you know, through windscreens and stuff, and he loved it. I think that he loved it because of the movies that he grew up loving as a kid. Yeah. You know, this is the stuff that they did in the 30s and 40s, and he wanted to be a part of that and comment on that and make his movies a part of that world, which, if you love film noir and you love crime movies and gangster films from America, you gotta love Melville, because he's a love affair with these images. I mean, this movie is his most noir because it's stylistically very impressionistic. It's got the long shadows, it's got the misty streets and the foggy street lamps and, you know, lone people, and it's just beautiful. You know, it's got the slanted ceilings that kind of trap people in the frame, and I can watch this movie over and over just because it's so good looking, you know, and it's just wonderful extension of the Hollywood gangster film, you know. And when I was watching these movies as a kid, young man, watching gangster movies and falling in love with Cagney and all, everybody else, Bogart and Robinson, I always wanted these guys to win, you know. I was like, those are the guys, you know. Look, but those are the guys with the real moral center, you know, and I always want, and so this is my fantasy is that Melville thought the same things when he was watching these movies as a kid and did it, you know, and he created the kind of movies that he wanted to see using all the elements that we love about noir and gangster films.
But they still usually get it in the end, even with him.
But the reasons they get it are totally for totally different reasons. And always, you know, it's a little bit tragic.
You know? Well, there's a line in Second Chance that I wrote down, and I'm going to just steal it and use it in something someday. But they're talking about the Leno character, and someone says he's doomed and he knows it.
Yeah,
it's like all these guys. They're all just marking time.
They're marking time. They're doomed and they know it. But you know.
But aren't we all?
I wish I'd said that.
The stories are about the price of loyalty, you know. The price of being beholden to a code. There's a wonderful twist in Ladulos that I don't want to give away. It would be criminal of me to do so. But there's what else can I say about this film?
You're doing pretty good.
This is one I have not seen, and I'm
I think it'll quickly become one of your favorites.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, we're on the same page so far. So.
It's just the camera work, you know, just the way he uses film. Like they, of course, Belmondo ends up at the police inspector's office, and he's sort of given him the once over and interrogate him, regular old scene in an office, but Melville never cuts the camera. It's about 4.5 minute take, and you don't notice that. It's so subtle that you don't notice that. It's all in the it's all in the blocking. Am I running out of time? Watch.
But you were mentioning, we were talking about the there was one exception in terms of the gender issue here that you were gonna.
What? Which is?
Oh no!
That would be Daybreak. I don't want to say stuff in French. I just butcher it. Le jour se lève.
I love it. He keeps looking at Joe like
as if I can speak French.
As if you already took your French. Le jour se lève.
What was the American title?
Daybreak.
Daybreak. I'm looking for my notes here because I want to talk about how do you say it? Jean Gabin. I want to talk about
Jean Gabin.
Jean Gabin. Yes. And of course, we need to talk about Marcel Carné.
Carné. Yeah.
Who has been forgotten? You know, I think
that's fair to say.
Carné was up there, you know. At a period of time, he was the most well-known and famous French film director. He literally defined the idea of the French movie star film. You know, it was like the Hollywood studio system, all the best parts of it put together into Carné's work. It was all shot on stage. The thing that happened with Carné, you know, it was all extremely well designed. He worked with Prévert,
Jacques Prévert,
who was a poet. And
madman, apparently. I mean, there's all sorts of. He was a tortured writer.
That's where we get the word Prévert.
Right.
Prevert. We say Prevert.
He's 100% Prevert.
The Colonel Baguano says it that way.
If that is your name.
Yeah, the poetry of the, the guy. They did four movies together, I think, and just the guys, it's just gorgeous. It's everything. It's so French. It's so beautiful and French. And
are you a Francophile?
I love French film, and I put my daughter in the French school here in L.A., so she speaks fluent French.
Yeah, well, we should have brought her.
Which is why I keep...
Her dad does,
which apparently. Is why I keep, hesitant, not trying to... Because my daughter just butchers me whenever I try to say anything, and so it's different for me. I butcher the French language. I get it at home. So am I a Francophile? I just have a deep love of French culture and French cinema. I know I wouldn't go so far as to call me a Francophile, but sure.
Did you ever live there?
I spent a lot of time there, but I've never had a place there. I almost bought a place a couple of times, and I want to buy a place outside somewhere in the country. Last summer, a couple summers ago, me and Harlow, my daughter, just drove around France for 2 weeks, and drove up into mostly the south and some of the middle. And so the next trip, we're going to go explore sort of the north and the east. And just getting an idea of the lay of the land, I love the people. I love the the Italians are in my humble experience have always been trying to rip you off. They love it. It's part of the culture. They take pride in it. They take pride in sort of like seeing what they can get over on you. It's part of the way they're built, it's part of their DNA. And believe me, it's there. They're still paying off the mob, in those.
The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily
so the Italians are one of them. It's gorgeous in Italy, but I really love France.
I kind of love the way this stuff keeps feeding back and forth, how the Americans make these gangster movies and then the French see them and then they feed, they do their version. And then
yeah.
You get a bunch of American filmmakers in the 60s, especially, who are watching these movies and then they're feeding them back.
Right.
I mean, we're at a point now. Do you ever go to the, there's that great City of Lights, City of Angels Festival that they do at the DGA every year. They show new French films.
Oh, great.
And I always make a point of going the night they show like a triple feature of new French crime films.
Yeah.
Because it's just, this is when I got into the business to write was kind of crime movies and westerns, which...
which unfortunately they...
Yeah, which is why I'm doing this podcast. but I love going because it's like the only place I get to go to see great American crime films anymore in this French film festival.
Do you see good ones? Are they still putting out some good ones?
They're still making the kind of great in the best way possible programmers, the kind of solid, the stuff I'd love to write. In fact, I'm writing a feature now for some French producers. Wow. We're adapting an American novel for a French film, which is that kind of thing that almost nobody's making here. But it's so interesting the way, it happens all over the world, but I feel like French particularly, the way they feed their stuff to us and then we feed it back to them and then we feed it to, because all these movies are inspired by obviously American films, although Daybreak is very French.
Daybreak is the first, 1939. It's really the first of a very rich genre of man trapped somewhere, reliving the circumstances of how he got there. And how is he going to get out of it, type of movie, the desperation, influenced, all of, the film noir stuff. So this really was, a godfather to a lot of the tone, of, films that would follow, Carnet was the, I don't know if he invented this, but man, the guy, his movies are, people call it poetic realism. Okay. He, from my money, Carnet and that kind of film where everything is thought out. The beautiful shadows, the misty streets, the way that the sets are built, and you know, the kind of jumbly houses that are kind of cramped on top of each other, but in this wonderfully artistic way, where you're like, I would definitely live there with no money. Like, I would love to live there. You know, you want to go there. You feel like you're breathing the atmosphere. It's the alt. He originated the atmospheric movie. Okay, so Ridley Scott, all the guys that we watch today were have to pay tribute to Carney, who was paying tribute to guys like Murnau and the silent films. Okay, the German. I think the Germans started. I don't know my history as well as I should, but the Germans and Murnau, you know, they started this sort of impressionistic, incredibly gorgeous style of filmmaking that really caught a lot of shit when the neorealists came along. You know, they rebelled against the artifice of the poetic realistic style. You know, so guys like Murnau, who was dead long before, but guys like Carney, who lived in 1996, was just crucified, you know, for his artifice, which they call artifice, you know, and what people, and this was a natural, you know, evolution. So, you know, there's no right or wrong here, but it's very sad that Carney's been, you know, lost and forgotten. His poetic realistic movies are some of the best films ever made. His Port of Shadows, which was made the year before and also starring Jean, was condemned by the French military and government for being anti-France. And they literally said, if we lose the war, blame it on Port of Shadows, you know, for his pessimistic, right. You know, attitude of that was prevalent.
Realistic.
And it was realistic. And Carney replied, you know, don't blame the barometer for the storm, you know. so he was caught up in all that. You know, he really caught the way that France was feeling at the time, and he paid for it. In both way, on both sides of the coin, you know, he was celebrated. The guy went on to do Children of Paradise, okay, which was probably the biggest moneymaker. It was France's Gone with the Wind. It's the biggest moneymaker in the history of France. I mean, the movie is a fucking masterpiece, and he delayed production because he knew that if I can stretch this out to make this the first movie of when we're finally free of the French occupation, rather than the first, you know, the last movie of our captivity, mm-hmm. then it will be a celebration. And that's the way he designed it. And that's a very thinly veiled sort of you know, thing for you know, living under occupation and then the freedom. And he was absolutely right. It's the pinnacle of his career. And nobody else in the movie, including him, ever hit such heights again. But it doesn't matter because, you know, even Truffaut, who slammed Carney and, you know, and was digging the grave and asking him to jump in it, said, you know, I would trade all of my 23 films to make one movie like Children of Paradise. Mm-hmm. So that was where he was going. His other poetic realism movies are great. My favorite two are Port of Shadows, which was 1938, also starring Jean Gabin, and the one we're going to talk about, which is Daybreak.
Should I
keep
talking?
Well, tell us about the girl.
Get to the girl. I'll tell you briefly what the setup is. The movie opens with a guy stumbling out of an apartment door. He's shot in the stomach and he falls down the stairs and he's dead and he's discovered by a blind man. And then, of course, that brings the police, and they go up to the apartment, and they knock on the door, and Jean Gabin shoots through the door, and he says, leave me alone. I just want to be left alone. Get the hell out of here. So this movie then goes back and forth between our hero, who's trapped in an apartment, surrounded by the cops downstairs and the crowd of people in the town, to his memories of the circumstances that got him here. Okay, so, you know, this is a classic setup. This is the first, you know, movies like Payphone or Man on a Ledge, they all are part of this wonderful genre that was written by Carnet and Prouvaire, whose girlfriend was, oh gosh, if I wrote down her name, let's see, his girlfriend
was.
No, Francois. No, it was.
Because they're both named Francois.
Right. They're both, yeah, Jacqueline Laurent. And this was Prouvaire's girlfriend. They met in the cafe, the famous cafe, and about 3 years before they had a stormy 4-year romance. This movie in 39 would have been toward the end of their romance. But essentially the writer cast his girlfriend as the girl. There's two girls.
It doesn't happen much.
I was going to say, that's not a thing that happens in America. Yet another reason the French are better.
She's absolutely gorgeous. She's beautiful. She's a wonderful actor. She actually looks a lot like Vera Clouseau. Mm-hmm. And who, for a second, I thought it was Vera Clouseau. Clouseau's wife, who was also in a bunch of Clouseau films, including Diabolique and Wages of Fear. This chick is, wonderful. I don't think I wrote down anything more about her. So Carnet plays Gabon. He plays worker, regular where he was. The guy is he wears a sandblasting outfit. We meet him at the he's blasting pieces of metal with these big sand guns, and he's got this giant leather sort of thing on. Like, he looks like a diving bell helmet, with the tiny slits for the eyes and air hose. It's just gorgeous. Like, so it's almost like something out of science fiction. And he's there. He's on an assembly line of other guys, blasting in the background. This gorgeous girl dressed all in white, carrying flowers, walks through and stops, and he looks around and he's like, okay, who the hell is that? Takes off his stuff, and they meet. It's the cute French meet cute scene where she's trying to deliver flowers, and her name is Francois, and his name is Francois, and they're both orphans. So they cut to 3 weeks later, and they're having this nice dalliance. They're at her place, and he's making the moves on her in a wonderfully French way. It's very sexy and cute and charming, and she's being kind of coy and not quite. He realizes that he's not quite going to get any tonight, And so he takes her teddy bear. He's like, well, if I'm not getting any tonight, then I'm going to take
this teddy bear. the way men do.
The way men do, I'm going to keep this with me for a while until you change your mind. And then his wonderful, he's like, yeah, something's up here. So he follows her, and she's like, I got to meet somebody. Like, okay. He hangs around outside and she leaves, and he walks behind her and he follows her into a cafe where what do they call them? Dance halls or show halls, where there's a little theater going on, and they've got, people on bicycles and, the little troupe of acrobats. And then this guy comes out on stage, who's a dog trainer, and he's doing these tricks with these pooches, and he's got a beautiful assistant, and the beautiful assistant, basically says fuck you in the middle of the show and walks off stage and walks to the back where she meets Gabon, and they strike up a little conversation, and she basically says that guy, could charm the pants, off a houseplant. The guy is a Lothario. He says he's got the words come tripping off his tongue when he talks, about the Riviera. You can feel the water up to your neck, he says. And so we start this sort of three-way love triangle between the dog.
Four-way, right?
In a way. But it really comes down to, yes, so Gabon starts, as the French do, and they all start fucking each other. But he's really in love with the flower girl, and this guy is making the moves on the flower girl in a way that the flower girl is, caught in his web. So it becomes about the dog trainer, and the sandblaster, and the flower girl, and sort of so really the movie is about crimes of the heart. You know, yes, there's a murder in the movie. Yes, he's surrounded by the cops and won't give himself up. But the murder, the way we play with each other's hearts, you know, and the damage that does, and the fragility of romantic relationships, and the real crime, you know, of abusing that or playing with that, you know. But I loved the guy who plays, his name is Valentin, the dog trainer's name is Valentin, and he's played by Jules Berry. And the way Jules Berry, I think, is probably one of the best actors of his generation. The guy is phenomenal.
He's amazing at this. Yeah, he's
very well trained stage actor, but he's also likable. You know, you just like to watch him move. The way he smiles and the way he moves his hands and the way he says, you know, I'm a fucking creep. I don't have any morals. But I'm free,
I
just say what I want, and I think of it, I have an idea, and I try it, I do it, you know, and there's a freedom in there, and you could almost see why women are attracted to that, you know, because he's not beholden to anything. So he's the antithesis of all the other characters that we've been talking about, who literally live and die by the code and what they say, and their word is their bond, and the bonds that we establish between each other are everything that we have, which is what Le Samurai says, you know, without this, we die. And this guy is cut all the cords and thinks that he is free, you know, and this gives him a wonderful power and freedom. Sure, he's a dog trainer and he travels from town to town and he doesn't have much money, but he's free. And he's free of all the complicated, messy stuff of the heart, you know. So he toys with females and he toys with men. He lies to Gabon and tells him this insane story that he is her dad, her long lost dad. He's like, well, but she's an orphan like me. It's like, no, yes, of course. But I went, I looked everywhere. It took me years and
don't
I found her.
Parents?
So what do you want to say about this?
I had not seen it before. And it sets you up. I think it's in the very beginning. You see the teddy bear and you know that he's killed this guy. Mm-hmm. And Nancy and I both had the same impression. Oh, somebody killed his child. That guy killed his child. That's what this is going to be about. No. And you're prepared, I think, for something more obvious.
Right.
And when you slowly start to realize it is just about
right.
It's about love. It's about romantic love.
Right, right, right.
Soured and destroyed and assaulted.
That's right.
Instead of the more kind of obvious.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with killing the guy who killed your child. But,
sure.
But that's a much more kind of blatant thing.
Or some other kind of con that Valentin was pulling, you know?
Yeah, there's these clues. Just this man is destroyed by his love for this woman.
There's these clues like, you know, this woman gives Gabon, she takes off this wonderful brooch and gives it to him. She says, I've had this my whole life. It was my mother's. You carry it. And then we come to find, you know, the other woman who's the dog trainer's assistant, who's played by Arletty, who is also a wonderful actress and a big star in her own right. Say, you know, she says, oh, you mean this? And pulls out of her suitcase the same brooch and then 10 more of them. He's like, you know, this guy gives one to every all of his conquests, you know. And you're thinking, you know, that, oh, this is going to be the beginning of some elaborate sort of scheme or con that Valentin is pulling, you know. But no, it's just he just likes toying with people's hearts and destroying them by accident.
And he's so good. He's so, there's something to it. He's sitting in the hotel room and the cops are outside and they're just shooting the fuck out of the place. And he's just sitting there. This is a man who's given up. He's not going to give up to the cops, but he's just sitting there as bullets are flying around the hotel room, just smoking his cigarette, waiting for the shooting to end. You get the sense that if it ends with his death, he's okay with that, too.
Yeah, yeah. And in his own way, you know, he's cut the cords and he's had to be free just to...
I want to ask, though, because it's funny, and I'm guessing, because I feel like we're a lot of on the same wavelength with this stuff, but maybe I don't know the answer, but you're not talking about the one everyone goes to of this.
And Rafifi?
No. Rafifi, we discussed it, but no mention of Breathless and Godard. Is that
that's not really one of these movies.
Well, okay, good, because I'm
and it's only incidentally a crime movie,
right?
And the beginning of a whole other if you talk about Breathless, then you're bringing in this whole other movement in film. And
the only rule about Breathless is you don't talk about Breathless.
No, I'm happy not to go into it, but I always feel like.
But Belmondo's movie that made him a giant star, and yes, he plays a hoodlum in the film. But no, it's just these, and I don't know, and it all is unconscious,
I think that movie somehow, to people who aren't fans of this stuff, who are still coming in, there's something about that kind of, everything else gets lost in the shadow of that. And if you have seen Breathless and have gone, not for me, these films are not like that.
Right.
Well, I'm not. I said that I'm always talking about stuff that I'm not a
a fan of.
I'm not a fan of Breathless.
No, I'm not a big fan of Breathless either, but it's a very important movie. It did a lot of stuff for the first time.
Yeah. And I think that all these movies, and we're talking about Daybreak right now, which it was highly influential to all these other films with its, it predates film noir. The noir lighting scheme was obviously borrowed from the impressionistic stuff that Carnet was riffing on, so these movies, especially this one, with its use of flashbacks, an American noir is so flashback, and the template of a doomed, decent man who's trapped in a claustrophobic situation. This was the grandfather, of all that stuff. It predates it by, like 10 years almost. So... 5 or 10 years, and directors like Jean-Pierre Melville and Dassin and Jacques Becker were all influenced, by this. The influences are everywhere for this Carnet film, even though it's a poetic, realistic film and only a crime film, ostensibly.
No, it's true. I think you're right, because it does. I'm like, well, what is the I should know this. This is terrible. Like, what's the Rocket 88 of film noir? Like the Ground Zero, the first.
Well,
Billy Wilder.
They vary.
Obviously, Dumb and Dumber is much later than this.
Well, and there's a movie called Stranger on the Third Floor,
right? Okay,
which is a B picture at RKO, which has an extremely long dream sequence in it, and flashback dream sequence about a trial. Which is done incredibly expressionistically with lots of, it's really cool, lots of shadows and stuff.
Yeah, they say that sort of thing.
And that is often pointed to as, because the phrase film noir didn't exist until the 50s.
No, until.
But, when you get into the Phantom Ladies kind of pictures and, right. The big clock and all these.
What year is Stranger?
Stranger was 1940.
So this really does, because this was the shocking thing. I had somehow misread something, and we're watching the film, and it gets to the end, and I look something up, and I had been thinking this was 10 years more. I thought it was like 1949, and to realize it's 39 was fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, and that whole poetic realism.
Because when you're watching it, thinking it comes after all these other films.
Right.
But then when you realize you're watching a movie that's doing all this stuff before...
He's the grandfather, Carnet, this guy's amazing. He started out as a journalist. He wrote some articles in the 20s about film, and that's what got him interested. And then he bought some film.
A lot of French journalists became filmmakers.
Yeah.
I believe there's, I think Kino is coming out with that soon on Blu-ray, is my understanding, which would be great. It's worth tracking down. But Thomas.
Oh, that was great. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Wow. I mean, really, thank you for coming in. That was the dream scenario. Not that we haven't had a ton of great guests, but the enthusiasm and
did I do okay?
I think you actually may have convinced some people to track down these movies, which is all you can hope for from a show like this.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm only from time to time, if we're talking to somebody about being on the show, I'll send them a link to one and I'm sitting here going like, I'm going like, on the one hand, this is the perfect one. On the other hand, like, I don't want them to hear it and then go, I got to do all that work.
And they're French.
They're
not even in English.
But no, thank you so much.
We love to have people on who love movies, and obviously you love movies.
Yeah.
And it was fun to do the little, look into this stuff a little bit, and it was great, a learning experience.
I got a recommendation for you. It's a picture you probably never heard of called Hail Mafia.
Nope.
Directed by Raoul Levy, shot by Raoul Coutard. And it's a hitman movie, and it stars Eddie Constantine, Henry Silva, Elsa Martinelli, and Jack Klugman.
Cool.
And it's black and white.
Hail Mafia.
Kind of grainy. Lots of mud. Lots of rain.
50s or
66.
Okay. Cool.
I think you can only get it from Sinister Cinema.
Wow.
I think that's the only people who have it.
Have you seen Blast of Silence?
I love Blast of Silence. I saw Blast of Silence when it was new.
No.
That's how old I am. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a...
I have all of the movies made by that director, which amounts to five. Yeah, or three, four, whatever.
That's the only one?
He did another one called Terror in the City.
Oh, cool. Is that worth checking down?
With Lee Grant. Yeah, you never find it.
Really?
Alan Barron is his name. He became a TV director eventually.
Oh, my God.
But Blast of Silence is a very cool movie.
Yeah. When I discovered that, I thought I was reaching.
It's a very late noir.
Early 60s. I thought it was.
But the Lionel Stander narration is it's baby boy Frankie Fane. It's really
one of those great movies.
Opening shot of the tunnel coming out of the
tunnel. It all takes place in Christmas. And the director is the lead in the picture because he couldn't afford anybody else.
Yeah, but so well done for that.
And it's got a great part. For the first time I ever saw an actor named Larry Tucker, who is a very big, rotund guy with a beard,
right,
who is great in Shock Corridor. He's the crazy guy in Shock Corridor, but this is the first time I ever saw him, and he later became a writing partner of Paul Mazursky.
Wow!
And I was involved with Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, and in fact, he's in the big ensemble at the end of the picture. But he's a really good. He was in Advising Consent too, but he was a really good actor. He had this really naturalistic quality.
Wow. Yeah, he's. I remember him in that, and we're gonna rewatch Shock Corridor now.
I can never see Shock Corridor too often.
Yeah, it's just too great.
But I love this. You know, it's because there weren't podcasts at the time, but just there's that community of freaks like us. Because I think I first saw Blast of Silence on a shitty dubbed bootleg VHS.
Yeah,
friend going, oh, you got to see this film.
Yeah,
and then cut to years later, I'm in France and I found a French DVD of it, which was really exciting. And now there's a Criterion.
I know. Yeah, Who would have ever thought?
Eventually, just from people making noise like we've been doing here.
That's what it's great for. I'm sad they shut down Filmstruck.
Well, Criterion Channel apparently starts next week. Well, not next week if you're listening to this. It's probably already started. But they're trying to do what Filmstruck did so well. And I'm looking forward to it. I'm hoping they made so many movies available for people who just didn't know where to find them.
And that is the plus side of this new age that we are Yeah. Living in,
yep.
You know.
You get to have the movies and see them in a tiny little screen and not see them with a big audience. But the alternative is you don't see them at all.
And then just getting people out, you know, even when they have the, you know.
Well, there's a noir festival that
going on right now.
By this time will be over.
Over, yeah.
At the Egyptian, which they have with great people.
And that attracts.
And those guys are really, Eddie Mahler and Alan Rode, they really love that stuff and they do a great job. And it's a touring show. It doesn't just go. It's in LA now as we do this, but then it goes elsewhere. It goes to San Francisco. Yeah. It goes to different cities.
Yeah, I'm friends with Eddie.
Yeah, Eddie's great.
Yeah, he really
Eddie
is.
Eddie loves his work.
I know, and I'm very happy for him on doing the TCM stuff now. I think that's just really great.
No, it's great.
You know,
I mean, there are people out there who love this stuff, and they've managed to channel. It is a niche, but it is because many of the people in the audience are dying off. but they are getting younger people interested.
There's always younger people at those things.
Yeah, they're always getting younger people interested. True. And noir is a great way for young people to get into black and white.
Yeah, yeah. And once you get in, I mean, geez, it's hard to get out.
It's so rich. I mean, there's just so many pictures.
And it's so much.
And there's so movies that were completely ignored when they were new. All those Richard Fleischer pictures for RKO.
Yeah.
The 65-minute movies. Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, that picture was on.
Charles McGraw.
That picture was on the shelf. That picture was on the shelf for almost 3 years.
Right.
Because when Howard Hughes owned it, and he said he thought, this picture's really good. I should remake it with big stars.
Right.
And so he didn't release it.
And then he reshot. They kept reshooting
His Kind of Woman. He reshot. He reshot the picture for a year. Vincent Price said it was the best job he ever had. He was on a movie for an entire year.
Our show was recorded in beautiful downtown Burbank. The official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.